Dude, we are going to energize the country.
We need to wake up and smell the coffee.
The independence case is a powerful one.
Another future is possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Gareth Walsh, the Energy Practice Lead for the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change, who in this podcast, we will be discussing a paper that he has contributed to called A Just Transition for Africa. Fascinating paper, which Gareth is one of the authors of. Welcome to the podcast, Gareth.
Hi, Will. Thanks very much. Thank you.
It's great to have you on, Gareth. And the first question that I would like to ask you is, how did you first get involved with the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change?
I guess for the first 10 years of my career, I worked with utilities, largely in the West. So UK, Australia, US, a little bit of work on financing, power trading, and then worked for the UK energy regulator, Ofgem. And during this time, I got the chance to do some work in Kenya and Indonesia on the energy sector. And that sort of helped to shape a decision on my part that I wanted to do some work in Africa. And I mean, it's partially that cliche about making an impact, but I guess, to be honest, more selfishly and more importantly for me, it was the work, the sort of the interest in the work to sort of build a system, have that kind of view across a whole power system, as opposed to being in the UK, where it's very fragmented, and you know you're only ever really looking at one piece of the puzzle. So I went and did a master's in Cape Town, actually, energy and development studies, and then through a friend I heard about the Tony Blair Institute, and at the time Tony was speaking to President Kagame of Rwanda about supporting their energy sector. They only about 20% of the country had access to power. They had huge power deficits. And I got in touch with the Institute. And then a few weeks later, I was off to Rwanda for what was supposed to be about an 18-month assignment. And I've been here since. So that was 2012. So that's a decade.
A very long 18 months, really, isn't it?
Long 18 months, yeah.
So the paper that we're going to be discussing today, as I just mentioned, is called A Just Transition for Africa. So could you tell the listeners how this particular paper came about?
Yeah, so you know, since I joined the Institute in 2012, we've grown in terms of our presence across Africa. We're currently working with 18 presidents and countries across the continent. And if I'm completely honest, until a couple of years ago, climate was not really a priority of the, you know, the presidents and the governments that we worked with. It was always jobs, energy. So 600 million people across Africa don't have access to electricity, agriculture, food security, but you know, avoiding emissions was never really a priority, which I think is understandable when you consider that Africa only contributes about 3% of global emissions. But recently, over the last couple of years, really, we've sort of seen an increasing recognition of climate's impact on the development of the countries we work in. So I think in two ways, really. First, the impact of climate change itself. So, you know, it's worth being clear again, you know, this isn't really a challenge of Africa's making, but Africa is in the front line of the impact. And I think, you know, nowhere is this more sort of viscerally clear than the example of Lake Chad. So Lake Chad is around sort of Nigeria, Chad, Niger, across the Sahel, a sort of key source of water and key to the livelihoods of about 40 or 50 million people. Temperatures there are rising about 50% more than they're rising across the rest of the globe. And since the 70s, this lake has reduced to about a fifth of its original size. And now it's one of the most food insecure parts of the world, with about 500,000 children suffering from acute malnutrition around there. You know, there are other examples in countries that we work in. So Hurricane Ida, which impacted Mozambique, Malawi, and Zimbabwe back in 2019. And at a macro level, you know, AFDB estimate that over the next 30 years, Africa's GDP will be about 20% lower than it otherwise would have been as a consequence of climate change. So there's definitely that angle of, you know, governments recognizing the impact that climate change is set to have on them. But then there's a second set of impacts which are almost more front of mind, if I'm honest, which are kind of the consequences of the reaction to climate change of us in the West. So, you know, there's a huge disparity in emissions between countries in the West and countries in Africa. So, you know, the average emission per person in the DRC is less than 0.5% of the average emission of someone in the US. However, on the part of the West, there's an increasing focus on curbing Africa's emissions, largely sort of by limiting finance and limiting development choices for them. And, you know, we saw this about 5 years ago, really on coal. And I'll be honest, I won't lose much sleep over that kind of coal. Coal isn't even an economic proposition in a lot of countries these days. But I think the sort of battleground that this has moved on to increasingly is gas. And, you know, a lot of the countries we work in are either looking to develop gas power plants or have gas fossil fuels. And, you know, they sort of see the hypocrisy of Europe and the US, which are still heavily dependent on gas, as you've seen by the recent price increases, trying to sort of restrict Africa's ability to move forward with things like that. So our sort of take on this is that climate change is obviously real, but it's not really a viable approach to mitigate it at the expense of Africa's development. Mm-hmm. And you know, we thought we'd write this paper to address this overriding feeling from the governments that we work with that the West is being hypocritical on this.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, as you say, you make the point in the paper related to the transition, particularly with cheaper fossil fuels like gas. So in the paper, you argue that for Africa to be able to transition in a way that is sustainable and doesn't impede the economic development of Africa as a whole, as you mentioned there, that collectively, HICs, or as you refer to them, high-income countries need to be able to pay for a financial bridge, which is the bridge between the cheaper fossil fuels like gas and slightly more expensive green energy sources. Now, how do you think that this financial package can be successfully argued as being necessary to the populations of high-income countries like the UK and the US? Because, of course, you will have people in countries like the UK and the US. And I mean, you mentioned the rise in energy bills in the UK, which is something that people in the UK will definitely be seeing at the moment. How can you argue to them that we need to give this financial package to help nations in Africa transition when we're already seeing an increasing cost of living in the UK and in other European countries, and the populations of those countries might obviously say, you know, well, why should we be giving money there when there are obviously serious financial problems occurring in countries like the UK and countries around Europe?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I think, I mean, the first point is, I think it is really a point of enlightened self-interest. So this is what we're really looking for is a fair way of addressing a global problem. First point I'd say is that fossil fuel technologies are often cheaper and more flexible in Africa than renewable technologies. So, you know, solar is only available when the sun shines, for example, whereas gas you can dispatch anytime. And if you want that solar power to be available at night, you have to invest in batteries, and that's going to cost you two or three times the price of producing power via gas. I think, you know, there are areas where renewables are cheaper. Standalone solar systems is a sort of a big success story, and is a great way of sort of rapidly expanding energy access. I think the second point to note is that, you know, Africa desperately needs low-cost energy to industrialize and create jobs. So, you know, in most countries across Africa, power is heavily subsidized. In reality, this subsidy means that they're moving money away from health and education to subsidize the power sector. And despite this, power costs in Africa are often much higher than power costs in Asia, with whom, frankly, Africa's competing to industrialize. So, from an African perspective, there's not really a strong case why an African country should pay more for their power and damage their global competitiveness to address an issue that's not of their creation. But I think from a global perspective, there's a very, very strong case for this. I mean, Africa clearly can't follow the same development path as the West or even China. if you consider Africa's population is going to double by 2050, it'll be about 2.5 billion people by then. And then if you multiply that by the growth that we hope and we expect will happen on the continent, the energy demand is going to be vast. And you know, even if Africa were to increase its emissions to the global average per person, by 2050, it'll be emitting more CO2 than China and India combined. So I would say, you know, it really is an issue of sort of enlightened self amongst every other country in the world to make sure that Africa does not follow the bad example that we have done in the West and China have done more recently.
Absolutely. Now, a bit ago, earlier on, you mentioned climate mitigation, and the paper is very clear in making a distinction between climate mitigation and climate adaptation. Now, do you think you could explain to the listeners what you mean by the terms climate mitigation and climate adaptation?
Yeah, there are a lot of words in this sector, a lot of confusing words. So mitigation basically is mitigating against the impact. So essentially avoiding CO2 emissions. You know, on that, obviously, Africa's contribution to these emissions is disproportionately small. Adaptation is adapting to what are sadly inevitable impacts of climate change. So this is, you know, being able to adapt and against things like weather events through enhanced food security, flood defences, approaches to handle migration of people. And I think on this, it's worth noting that Africa's adaptation needs are the biggest of any area of the world, in part due to unfortunate geography. They just happen to be bearing the biggest consequences climatically, but also because of the low incomes across the continent and the lack of infrastructure. And, you know, frankly, one of the best ways to adapt to the impacts of climate change is not to be poor, is to develop.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of development as well, I think one of the interesting things that you raise in the paper is climate finance. So the ability of how to be able to finance things related to climate change. Now, how well is climate finance working in the moment in terms of building infrastructure in Africa and ensuring that there are that there is money going into different African nations in terms of giving them help for building the infrastructure for to deal with climate change? I mean, is climate finance something that's going well in Africa at the moment, or is it something that's not going as well?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's fundamental getting money flowing to Africa for funding the increased costs of the green alternatives to fossil fuels, paying and incentivizing countries to maintain carbon sinks. So Africa has some of the world's largest carbon sinks, which actually absorb CO2. And, you know, as we've said, so helping African countries adapt to a crisis that isn't of their making. So climate finance, I mean, I think there are four big challenges, really. The first is there's a credibility issue, which frankly has come from this failure of developing countries to honor a commitment that was made back in 2010 to channel around $100 billion a year to developing countries to help with both climate mitigation and climate adaptation. This hasn't been honored. The deadline for this was 2020. The latest numbers that are available are from 2019, and you know, the total commitments then were around 80 billion. To be honest, I was at COP this year, and this was a bit of a shadow hanging over COP and a bit of a stain on the West's credibility. But you know, even beyond that, there's then the type of money that's being given, and you know, African countries would argue far too much of this money is coming in the form of loans, not grants. There's a third issue, which is, you know, how the money that actually was committed and was channeled was spent. And you know, only a quarter of the money that was channeled to developing countries was actually spent on adaptation. So that's about 20 billion in 2018. There's a UN estimate that by 2030 the developing countries will need around $300 billion a year. So, you know, there's a huge shortfall. And I think another another thing that sort of grates with African countries is the focus on spending this money on mitigation, i.e. preventing them, helping prevent them from emitting, rather than adaptation, which is kind of helping them adapt to the mess that we've created. So, you know, a good analogy is that there's this global lake that we're all sitting around and the West's been pouring toxic mess into it for a century. And that's all piling up on Africa's shores. And our focus is on telling them not to pollute rather than helping them sort of adapt to the mess that we've created. I think there's one final issue, and I think this is very important. So looking forward, in that there's been a heavy reliance, well, historically, for the last 10 years or so, there's been a heavy reliance on this concept of blended finance, particularly on developing infrastructure across Africa. And this came out of this billions to trillions agenda, which started from the perspective that development finance is limited, but there are huge pools of private capital in the world. And what we should be doing is using this development finance as much as possible to leverage that private capital. So, you know, de-risk investments to bring that private capital on board. And it's a very sensible approach if you look at, you know, the magnitude of these different pools of capital. Development finance is ultimately going to be limited. It has a ceiling, so it's a very sensible approach. However, you know, to be honest, it's had its failings. So this approach has been adopted on infrastructure, as I say, for the last 10 years or so. And there are a couple of major challenges. I mean, the first one is that the leverage, if you like, is very low. So by leverage, I mean the volume of private finance that we're attracting for each pound of development finance that we put in is actually quite low. And most estimates are that this is less than one. So, you know, for every dollar that we put in of development finance, we're not even managing to match it by immobilizing private finance. And then the second big challenge with this, and this is going to be particularly acute as it relates to climate change, is that when you're bringing private capital in, there's inevitably a focus on projects that can be turned into a profit. So if you look at what's happened on the infrastructure side, you know, we've reasonably significant levels of finance have been channeled into power generation, for example, where there are, you know, pretty standard terms through which a private investor can generate a return. There's a huge shortfall in other areas, though, like water supply and sanitation, which are less easy to monetize and make a profit from. And I think this issue of blended finance is still considered, and I think rightly, as, you know, one of the solutions to climate finance moving forward. But I think it's a pretty big risk to sort of just move forward sort of business as usual without taking a sort of serious look at some of the failings and some of the challenges that we've encountered to date on the infrastructure side.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things, I mean, you mentioned this earlier in terms of obviously, you know, African countries see a certain hypocrisy in that the West has been using energy sources that have damaged the climate as means of improving themselves economically and building themselves up, and now having a, you know, a sort of a go or criticizing African countries for doing the same. And one particular country that you focus on and highlight in the report is Mozambique, which is used as an example of a nation that is profiting particularly from gas in terms of helping its GDP, and which of course then helps the people of Mozambique by raising living standards and improving the overall financial state of the nation. So in terms of nations like Mozambique, how do you think that you can convince countries like Mozambique that are getting financial rewards from the fossil fuel sector to move to renewables?
I mean, I perhaps controversially think that in the short term we shouldn't. I mean, I think it's worth a bit of context here, right? So Mozambique is a country of 30 million people. Their electricity consumption, did this calculation the other day, actually, their electricity consumption is less than the UK uses on washing machines, right? Mm. They're a country where the GDP per capita is $500. The UK is a country where GDP per capita is $40,000. And Mozambique's sort of emissions per person are incredibly low. So sort of looked at this. So today we're talking on the 20th of January. Mm-hmm. By today, this year, the average person in the UK will have contributed more CO2 emissions than the average Mozambican will have over this entire year, right? So just to sort of clarify the scale of the disparity here. And I mean, you stack against that the benefits for Mozambique. So the gas could increase government revenues by about $4 or $5 billion a year. And you know, for a country like Mozambique, this is critical. This is money that can go into education, health, drive development. You're also producing gas, which can help to low-cost power, which, mm-hmm. as we've said before, is critical to drive industrialization. So I think if you take the perspective that there's a finite carbon budget left in the world, and you know there's a finite amount of carbon that can be emitted, which most sensible people do, I think driving development in an area like Mozambique is a good use of that. And mm-hmm. you know, I think it's incredibly difficult to argue to a country like Mozambique that they shouldn't, particularly if you, I mean, I saw in the news recently that there's an airline in Europe that have flown 18,000 empty flights across Europe just to maintain land. Slots, right? So yeah. Yeah, if you're talking about exploiting gas so that a country can fund education and health versus that, I think it's a very, very difficult sell. I think what we can do is we can start supporting them on their energy transition and not, as a lot of Western governments are sort of looking at now, by limiting their development choices, but by helping them sort of slowly bring on board alternatives. So they have huge hydro potential, for example. There are a couple of large hydro projects that we're supporting them to develop that can help not only their energy transition, but also the energy transition of South Africa and other countries in the region.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, as you say as well, that Mozambique is a nation that is obviously using gas to be able to help its citizens and to improve itself financially. So therefore, do you think that Mozambique is a good example of a nation that is using not as harsh fossil fuels like coal, but is using gas to help increase its GDP and keep itself functioning? And do you think, therefore, that it's going to be an important example of how nations that are still using a lot of coal, which obviously cause a hell of a lot of emissions. Mozambique is a great example of a nation that is using a less harsh fossil fuel to improve itself, and that Mozambique's example will convince other countries that are using things like coal to transition to gas and then eventually transition to renewable energy.
I mean, gas... So gas is very important for the transition for a couple of reasons. As you say, it's not coal. it's sort of in per unit of energy per kilowatt hour, it's around half as environmentally damaging as coal. But it is also an enabler of the transition to renewables. So producing power from gas is a very, very flexible way of producing power. You can fire up and fire down a gas turbine pretty quickly. So gas is perfect to offset the variability of renewables like wind and solar. So when the wind isn't blowing or the sun's not shining, you can fire up the gas turbines. I think Mozambique's role in the energy transition can probably be considered a little bit closer to home. So if you look at the sub-region in which Mozambique exists, South Africa's heavily dependent on coal. Mm-hmm. One of the bright spots of COP was this sort of $8.5 billion global commitment to support South Africa's transition away from coal. And gas, along with renewables, is going to be a key part of that transition. Also, you know, Mozambique's gas has a major role to play to support existing hydro. So neighboring countries like Zambia and Malawi have a significant number of dams that they rely on for their power. And as a consequence of climate change, in many ways, the output of these dams is decreasing. You know, and a lot of this is actually of our making, to be honest, in the West. So you know, gas can actually help to offset this, balance this, and address that. I think on this is one of the very important aspect that often gets overlooked, which is cooking. So the vast majority of Africa still relies on wood and charcoal to cook. Mm-hmm. And this is extremely polluting. If you can imagine burning blocks of wood inside your house or burning charcoal inside your house, it's extremely polluting. And globally, this leads to around 4 million premature deaths a year. Mm-hmm. 600,000 children die a year as a consequence of indoor cooking with wood and charcoal. And gas is basically the primary technology to shift away from that. I mean, most houses in Europe or the US to rely on gas for cooking. So I think to tell a country like Mozambique that they can't develop gas when, you know, there are 600,000 children across the world dying from burning wood in their houses is, again, quite a difficult position to take.
Absolutely, absolutely. The report also highlights Nigeria, because recently there have been financial reforms in Nigeria that have allowed for electricity to be more widely distributed to consumers. Now, how important do you think internal financial reform is for African nations which wish to pursue the goal of greener energy?
I mean, so financial reform and, you know, addressing basically getting the power sector working, I think, is the most important thing. It's step one. Frankly, I think it's more important than just building more renewables. So the kind of very simplistic strategy to decarbonizing a country is to use electricity to power as much of the economy as possible. And, you know, you see in the West where it's then used into vehicles and things like that, and then make that electricity as low carbon as possible. That's very simplistically the strategy for decarbonizing a country. Mm-hmm. But the starting point of that has to be a functioning power sector. So Nigeria is an example of where this is desperately needed, and there's been some progress recently. So in Nigeria, we've been supporting the vice president's office on power sector reform for a couple of years now. I guess just by way of context, so Nigeria has a population about three times that of the UK. But the country consumes about a fifth of the power of the UK. One in 12 households in Nigeria have a generator when the power is not available, which, you know, until recently was very, very often. They fire up the generator and burn diesel. And this diesel is massively polluting, about three times more polluting than using power from the grid, and also massively more expensive. So four or five times more expensive than power from the grid. So kind of addressing this challenge is a massive economic and environmental imperative. So, you know, addressing this, there's been progress recently. Fundamentally, this is a challenge of incentives. So there are distribution companies in Nigeria who they buy the power and then they sell the power to the consumers. And essentially, they were not collecting enough money. So they were also buying power for more than they were allowed to sell it for. The price was regulated, which resulted in huge underinvestment in the sector, and also very little incentive, or actually even a negative incentive, for these distribution companies to sell this power. So addressing this is obviously a huge political challenge. It's quite difficult to tell the population in a country like Nigeria that you're planning to increase the tariff to address these issues when the quality of supply is so poor. Yeah. So we work with the government to sort of work through the politics of this, which was, you know, as you can imagine, quite a long, complex process. And the conclusion was that we should have a tariff based on the quality of supply. So essentially, you know, customers would pay based on the quality of supply that they were getting. And that's moved forward. And Nigeria is in a situation now where there's about 20% more power is going to be sold through the system this year than was last year. This results in less diesel being burnt in generators. This results in huge savings in terms of CO2. So it's about 3.5 million tons of CO2 being saved. And just for scale, that is equivalent to delivering about 3,000 megawatts or about $4 billion worth of solar investment, which is more than has been installed across the whole of Africa in the last 6 years. So, you know, getting the fundamental sort of flows of finance right through the power sector, I would say, is the most fundamental issue that needs to be addressed. And if you have a working power sector, it's actually relatively easy then to change what you're putting into it, you know, move away from gas to renewables. But if you don't have a functioning power sector, then it's you know, it's impossible. You're just wasting money by investing in solar or whatever that might be. I think on the, I guess on the topic of markets, another big area that I think really needs looking at is power trade. So African countries are increasingly becoming interconnected. You know, we have power markets in Europe. There's a similar aspiration across Africa, but trade is very, very limited. And we did an analysis a couple of years ago looking at the potential savings of power trade across West Africa. And, you know, I guess the most important conclusions is if you look at transporting power from countries that have a surplus, be it of gas or be it of renewable power, to countries that either have a deficit or are still reliant on burning diesel and heavy fuel oil, basically the oil that ships are powered from, you could save about $30 billion across the region over this decade, and you could massively reduce emissions. You could reduce emissions to the extent of taking all the UK's diesel cars off the road for a year. So, you know, this is, I think, where the big value is. And I think this is where, you know, the Western countries should be partnering with African countries. The big challenge is to get any of this done, you know, to get markets to work is complex and inherently incredibly political. And one of the challenges the West have, just being completely candid, I guess, is the push that they have for renewables and this kind of taking financing off the table for things like gas is really damaging their relationship and really sort of closing off the space that they have to work in areas like this.
Yeah, absolutely. Something else that is also important, and you mentioned it in relation to the burning of wood, is all obviously deforestation. And the removal of trees, and of course the impact that then has on the climate. And Gabon is mentioned as a nation that is particularly important given how much of its forest it has maintained. And there is an argument there, the need to provide some form of financial reward for it as a nation because it has maintained so much of its forest. So how best do you think that financial reward could be directed to nations like Gabon that have protected their forests and have ensured that there hasn't been the same sort of scale of deforestation as we've seen perhaps hundreds of years ago in Europe or that we are seeing at the moment in nations like Brazil?
Yeah, so, I mean, this is a big challenge. So you've got a country like Gabon, which is 85% rainforest, one of the few countries in the world that's actually an absorber rather than an emitter of CO2, absorbing emissions equivalent to the emissions of Holland, actually. So like a significant kind of sink of carbon. And there's a huge global benefit of this. But obviously there is a cost to Gabon. there's an actual cost to maintaining it. And then if you compare them to a country like Brazil, there's been a historical cost and an opportunity cost of foregone earnings from whatever it may be, logging trees or planting crops, agricultural revenues. But I guess despite this, there's still not really a formal mechanism to reward countries like Gabon for the value of their forests. And, you know, this is replicated across Africa. You know, there's Cameroon, there's the Democratic Republic of Congo. There are lots of African countries that are in a similar situation. I mean, European countries a number of European donors have sort of stepped up, European donor countries, and they're paying Gabon around $5 to $8 for every ton of carbon that these forests actually absorb. But this is on an entirely voluntary basis. And I think, you know, there are a couple of challenges with this. The first is the value that they're getting. So if you look at the European carbon trading scheme, the incentive on a European company to avoid emissions is around $100 a ton, which is, you know, obviously significantly more than the $5 to $10 and that Gabon are getting for the carbon that they're absorbing. So that's one challenge. I think the other major challenge is that this is a voluntary scheme. There's still no sort of clearly defined global architecture for them to be rewarded and incentivized for what they're doing. And this is a voluntary scheme that's sort of at the largesse of Western governments, which inherently means it's unreliable. So I think there are you know, there is a need to get all of this sorted out and all of this in place. And, you know, it sort of relates to what I said at the beginning about fairness. You know, it's not for us to say what's fair, but unless there is this sort of a global architecture and flows of finance in place that African countries and other countries can at least look at and say is credible. Can at least look at and say, you know, that in some way is sort of realistic based on the, you know, the role that we've historically played in emissions and the role that we're playing in emissions now. And any sort of move to address climate change, I think, is doomed to failure in reality, because, you know, if you want people to play ball, they have to appreciate, understand that there's something fair. You know, democratic countries won't stand for something that isn't. I don't think the UK would.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I completely agree. Now, you mentioned attending COP26 earlier, and I just wondered, just for the listeners, I mean, what was it like attending COP26? What did it feel like? Because it must have been a sort of a very strange experience, given how much attention was on the conference and how pivotal it was seen as.
Yeah, I'll be honest, I didn't really notice the attention when you're there, because sort of too busy being there. The daily COVID testing was a pain. I know there was a lot of talk about issues of venue capacity and queues. I didn't experience that, to be honest. I think the UK did a good job of making sure that people who needed to attend could attend, and, you know, people from other countries were vaccinated before they came. I mean, we were there primarily because we had a number of the countries that we work with. We had advisors supporting their delegations, so we're supporting delegations from Sierra Leone, Cote d'Ivoire, Togo. I'll confess, we weren't involved in the negotiations. I mean, there's no reason why we should be. I won't really comment on that. But from a, you know, as I said before, from an African perspective, the failure to honour the $100 billion a year was a bit of a cloud. I think it was quite well structured. So the first week was a bit of a trade show. Not disparagingly, it was actually a constructive session. I think it helped to set the tone. There were a lot of, you know, announcements that weren't a part of the core COP settlements, but sort of peripheral announcements and coalitions of countries and philanthropists and private sector getting together. And there were announcements, like there was this, as I mentioned before, this $8.5 billion to address South Africa's transition. There was, from our perspective of interest, there's $1.5 billion announced to help protect the Congo Basin. There was an announcement of around $25 billion to fund an adaptation accelerator program to help Africa's sort of adaptation. So I think all of that, having all of that in the first week was actually very good and very useful to sort of build momentum. You know, the governments that we're supporting with spent a lot of time during that first week showcasing projects and investments to, you know, as I say, it was a bit of a trade show. So showcasing their projects and investments to, whether it's development finance institutions, potential private investors, philanthropists. So I think that was good. I mean, there's still a bit of skepticism, I think, a well-justified skepticism based on kind of what's happened historically about whether this money will actually and the pace at which this money will actually flow, but you know, that was the sense was a reasonable level of optimism on that side.
Mm-hmm. And optimism is, of course, something that certainly in relation to the climate and climate change is something that we need, certainly. We're coming towards the end of the podcast, Gareth. It's been fantastic to have you on, and I have one final question. We've of course been discussing climate change primarily in Africa and how to deal with it, but obviously it is something that affects the entire world and affects everyone living on Earth. So my final question to you is this: if you could magically click your fingers and change one thing about global climate policy, what would it be?
I think it's what we've been discussing. I think it's a fair, getting a global architecture established that every country can regard as fair. If you look historic, there's a huge disparity now in terms of emissions per person in different countries. There's a huge, huge disparity now in terms of cumulative global emissions per person per country. And I think until there's a solution to that, until there's a sort of architecture set up that different people in different countries can regard as fair, things are not going to progress at the rate that's necessary. I think you will always have, you know, as you're having in the UK, you know, you're having in the US, you're having people say, why should we do this if China are not doing this? In Africa, you know, you will have the why should we do this given that the UK have been polluting for 120 years? They had their industrial revolution in the 1800s. We're having ours in the 2020s, right? You're always going to have that. So I think the most fundamental thing is to get that global agreement in place that people can at least regard as being in some way fair.
Well, I think that is a fantastic thing to hope for and to wish for, and something that I know that you are working very hard to achieve with the Institute. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast, Gareth. If people want to find out more about you and more about the paper and the Institute, where should they go to find out more about you and the paper and the Institute?
They can go to the Institute website, which I can't recall off the top of my head, but I think if you Google Tony Blair Institute and just transition, you'll find the paper. And I'm open to people getting in touch. So people feel free to email me on g.walsh@institute.global.
Fantastic. Well, thank you once again for coming on the podcast, Gareth.
Great. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, @DebatedPodcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.